Welcome to Latte with a Lawyer, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the stories of some of America's most successful lawyers, figuring out what makes them tick, how they creatively solve problems, and how others aspiring to be them can follow in their footsteps.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Latte with a Lawyer. I'm your host, Jonathan Brickman, and this morning we have with us Russell Brown. And he's with the law firm of Clark Quinn. Good morning, Russell. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. Good. Nice to have you. So just to kick things off, morning latte with a lawyer. What's your morning jet fuel to get started?
I generally am a coffee with cream and sweet and low, but it depends. I can also do a Diet Coke if needed. So I'm equal opportunity.
Equal opportunity caffeine consumer.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, where's your coffee now or your Coke? I don't see one with you.
I got right here. So
there you go. Mickey Mouse. There you go.
Got a Mickey Mouse cup.
Is that from Disney World?
It is from the first time I took my now 14-year-old. So that's a souvenir from that trip.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. Everybody's got to make that pilgrimage to Disney World.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I live in South Florida now, so I've been there too many times.
a little bit bigger trip to get there from Indianapolis.
Yeah, from Indianapolis. Is that where you're from? Is that where you grew up?
I grew up out west. I grew up in Colorado and Wyoming, and then but I've lived in Indiana for the last 23 years. So so it's home now.
All right. Excellent. Good. Is that where you went to a law school? Is that what got you there?
I did. Yeah, I went to IU Indianapolis. I went as a part-time student, so I went back a little bit later, and I worked for 3 or 4 years between undergrad and law school, but went part-time, so it took 3.5 years, including summers.
Good. Excellent. I always like hearing that when people don't go straight from undergrad to law school. What kind of work did you do before you decided to become a lawyer?
I worked in politics. So I worked a year in retail, then worked in politics. So I worked on a campaign, then worked for the governor of the state of Indiana for about 18 months, and then worked in state government. And so I was a young kid and looked around, and everybody who was above me on the org chart either had a law degree or they were 25 years older than me. And so I realized that I could get the law degree faster than I could be 25 years older. And so that's what that gave me the idea of going to school. And then the ability to do it part time was really attractive to me because I could continue to, you know, continue to work, didn't have to take out as much student loan debt to go. And so that was why I chose to go part-time. I had opportunities to leave the state and go full-time some other schools, but chose to stay and go part-time here.
Oh, interesting. I like that. So you're a self-made guy.
I don't know about that, but I had, at the time, I was married, and you know, we made some choices as a married couple that I think benefited us very well. So
okay, good. Who was it? So the governor, was that Mike Pence or was it someone?
No, it was Frank O'Bannon. So he was immediately after Evan Bayh. So Evan Bayh was in the from 88 to 96, and then Frank O'Bannon was from 96, and he passed away in office in 2003.
Oh, okay, got it. Where'd you get your interest in politics?
You know, I don't really know where that came from. Yeah. I actually interned when I was in undergrad. I interned I went to college in Arkansas and interned in then Governor Mike Huckabee's office. Which was funny because he is not of the same political persuasion that I am, but I actually got getting the job from our local state senator, who then became Attorney General and then later governor of the state of Arkansas, who was my political persuasion. But I got a lot of ribbing the whole time I was in the governor's office as you know, the guy from the other party. But it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. And then looked for opportunities to kind of get back into politics after a year in retail, and was super happy to land a work on a campaign, and then was very, very blessed to land in the governor's office.
Oh, wait, so that government was of the other political persuasion?
Governor Huckabee was. Yeah,
well, not so, Governor Huckabee. I mean, in Indiana, yeah, were you on the campaign?
So I worked for governor of my own party, and then I actually ran for state senate spot. My last
did you
year,
really? No kidding.
My last year in law school, I was not successful, but then was filled a vacancy in a local township office. A couple years into my practice, and so I did that while also practicing.
Oh,
so
nice.
Did that for about 5.5 years.
And you're not involved in any government?
I'm not. I have a position, an appointed position, on a commission here in town, but not an elected official anymore. Don't hold any political any offices in our political party currently. No.
Okay. Very good. Well, I'm gathering that you're maybe a bit of an outlier anyway in the state of Indiana. Is a pretty conservative place, right?
It is, yeah. Indianapolis is, like many metropolitan areas, is pretty is more progressive, but yeah, generally Indiana is a more conservative, especially once you're outside of the metro area.
Yeah, you're right, like most cities. But you're from what'd you say, Colorado?
Yeah, I grew up in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Which is also that's a conservative place too, right?
Fort Collins is probably pretty moderate.
Is it?
You know, it's not liberal like Boulder is, or you know,
Boulder's on the other end of the spectrum. Yeah.
So Fort Collins is a pretty moderate place. The county is more conservative, but you have a really interesting mix, because you have environmental concerns and you have farming concerns, and you have, kind of that real push and pull that you have to get
the Air Force, right? The Air Force Academy.
Air Force Academy is in Colorado Springs.
Oh, Colorado Springs. Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. I got that mixed up. Is there something in Fort Collins too?
Colorado State is in Fort
Collins.
Colorado
State.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, Fort Collins is about 60 miles from the Wyoming border. So.
Okay. Got it. We must get a lot of snow up there.
We get a lot of sunshine. Denver and Fort Collins get about 300 days of sunshine a year. Fort Collins is right at the edge of the foothills. And so you get a decent amount, but not as much as obviously if you're in the mountains.
Yeah. No, every time I go skiing out there, I pray that the roads are going to be clear when I go over the pass. Last time I went there, I was like, oh my, it was horrible. I didn't think I was going to make it.
Yeah, it's a Loveland Pass. It's generally the first pass you kind of go up on 70 as you leave Denver. Yes. And it can be very, very treacherous for sure.
Oh, boy. Thank God I had a driver that day. Honestly, it scared the wits out of me. Like, that's a reason not to go skiing in Colorado.
It is. It's a very treacherous drive. As you go up to the Eisenhower Tunnel and that way, it can be very treacherous in the it's beautiful, but can be be a difficult drive.
Oh yeah. For someone that's, I live in South Florida, for someone that's used to being on dry pavement with sunshine, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. We always look out for the cars from Texas with always the cars you look out for, because they weren't quite sure what to do on that stuff.
I know we're on a tangent, but the last time I was there a couple years ago, we went up there and everything looks great. We're flying to Denver. It's dry and we start to go. And I know there's going to be some precipitation. We get up on the pass, sheet of ice, snow. It's like, oh my God. I look to the right of me. There's somebody driving a Corvette.
Not the vehicle of choice. Sheet of ice.
I mean, I don't know if that person lived or died or, but. Anyway, so let's talk about your law practice. What kind of law you practice there?
I primarily do real estate work. Probably 70% or so of my real estate work is real estate stuff. It's split pretty evenly between transactional work and zoning work. So I do a decent amount of both sides of that. Depending on the time of year, it could be heavier on one side than the other. We also do... We have pretty good for a small firm, have a pretty good municipal services kind of group services, do a little bit of corporate transaction formation work. And then I still occasionally write a will or helps us friends do a little bit of, estate planning work. So we're a smaller shop. I became a lawyer in 2007. So it was the worst time in the world to become a real estate lawyer. as the bubble burst, and he had a pretty significant slowdown. So I did a lot of just general practice work my first 3 or 4 years of practice, which is great because it gives me a pretty broad perspective. I did a handful of divorces during that period of time. I did, just kind of general litigation during that time as well. But really, when the opportunity arose to come back and do, become the real estate guy, I was more than happy to kind of, take on that role in the firm and happy to have a practice that allows me to continue to do that.
Oh, good. And what's the focus of the firm in general?
We're pretty close to a full service firm. We don't do bankruptcy work. We don't do much criminal law anymore. We don't do, kind of trademarks, patents, and don't do bond work. But otherwise, have folks who do a variety of things. I have some folks who do some significant utility services work. Have a pretty big alcohol and hospitality practice. Have some construction litigation work as well. So then have one partner who solely does estate planning and work as well. And then a couple of good lawyers who are just kind of street lawyers, do whatever comes in the door, and have that ability to service clients in a variety of ways.
Okay. How many lawyers in the firm?
14. And then we have a land use planner who I work with as well, who does assist a lot in our real estate practice and our zoning practice. I'm licensed in both Indiana and Kentucky. And so we do a decent amount of cell tower work in the state of Kentucky. We do quite a bit of that. A lot of that is regulatory. And so she assists with a lot of the regulatory work in Kentucky.
Oh, is that still a big business, expanding the network?
It is, yeah. So we've historically done work for one of the major carriers. It goes in cycles like everybody's work does. And a lot of times it'll be a big boom. It'll be a big build cycle. And then it will be, kind of a reuse of existing infrastructure. And then there'll be another big boom. The 5G rollout has really, focused some energy more on residential areas. And so we've spent a lot of time in 2020, 2021 working on small cell rollouts, so in residential areas. So I spent a lot of time with a lot of angry neighbors talking about putting 30 and 40 foot poles in neighborhoods to provide that residential service. And so it's as the market and the product has continued to shift, their priorities shift as well. So it's great. We assisted a client when the Super Bowl was here in 2012 and did a lot of in-building networks for the hotels, for the convention center, for the stadium. And so that was a really interesting project. And when you were literally putting, pretty high-tech distributed antenna systems into a variety of hotels around, and our client happened to be a major sponsor of the event, and so they wanted to make sure that they had great service for their clients. And so it's a pretty cool industry to have a hand in, a small hand in.
Oh, interesting. So is that where a lot of your time is spent in that, or just other kind of construction work?
So it kind of ebbs and flows. At times it can be, where we're doing that pretty intensely. We do it across the state of Indiana as well as in Kentucky. Yeah. And so I've been to a lot of small little towns and large, you know, larger cities doing that work. We have a handful of, I have a national grocer client. I have a number of convenience clients. You can think convenience store and gas stations. We represent a number of kind of regional multifamily developers. I have a pretty broad practice as far as, you know, the types of end users that go into the projects that I'm involved in.
Okay. And turns out you're not doing litigation with this stuff.
I don't do litigation, no. I prefer to walk that down the hall and have somebody else take it from me. So
okay. Got it. Aside from your time as in the political arena, and when you started, when you had a law degree, what else drove you to become a lawyer? Why did you make that decision?
You know, I actually thought I would get back into government when I graduated. I thought I'd get back into either state government or municipal government. So I wasn't sure that I would actually be in private practice. But the opportunities that came along that were most attractive to me upon graduating were in private practice. And so I had a couple other public service opportunities and just didn't think that they matched up with what I wanted to do, where I saw myself in, you know, 5 or 8 years. Political work is always dependent on the next election. And so, you know, it's nice to have a practice or a job that I can, you know, I'm not as dependent election to election, which is something I don't miss, is having my, you know, my fate decided by voters every 4 years, two years. But it's funny is that I've now, when people ask me about, you know, if you think about going to law school, my comment always to them is, well, make sure you want to practice, because I think, given the debt that goes along with a law degree for, you know, 95% of people, you know, just to have that debt outstanding, you need to make sure that you have an income that allows you to deal with that. And private practice is, you know, generally the best way to achieve that. And so that's the advice that I give to folks. I don't know how many people take it, but it's always the thing that I give to folks. Hey, let's think, here's what it looks like, here's what my world looks like, and, you know, make sure that that's something you think would be attractive to you. If you go through this 3 years and sit and pass the bar, and, you know, then this is what life looks like for a while.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the economics are definitely a consideration for sure. What other reasons do you tell someone to become a lawyer aside from the financial burden?
No, I think I always just tell them to make sure that they understand kind of what it is. It's a client service industry. And I think, you know, or for most people, it's a client service industry. And I think that, you know, that's, make sure you understand what that means. I mean, it means you have clients who have expectations, or you get paid. Someone described it once to me as, you get paid to handle other people's stress.
Right.
And, you know, that's, you got to be have a certain kind of mentality to take that on. You know, my clients, when I did divorce work, one of the best compliments I got from a client was, since I've hired you, my stress level has gone down. And that was a huge compliment to me, because it meant that I was providing the services they hired me for. But I think it's a shift if you are sometimes taking on those stresses for your client. I encourage people to just think through that. That's what, if you're in private practice, that is a large portion of what you are doing, is you are seeing people in, mostly in times of need. Right. You know, when my clients call, they're always, you know, mention that I haven't heard from them in a while, and, you know, they're always like, well, it's nothing personal, but, you know, we didn't, you know, it costs us money when we call you, and that's true, it does. And so I try to be mindful of that as well, that, look, you know, people are paying for your experience and your knowledge, and make sure that you give high quality to them when they do call.
Got it. So aside from, you know, obviously you got to have patience, you got to be empathetic. I mean, what are the skills and traits that you need to be successful as an attorney or doing the kind of work you do?
I think you got to be have a willingness to do the work. So I think, you know, there's a lot of people who wash out, I think, that aren't willing to do the work. And I think, you know, that's always a challenge. I think you got to be, you have to have an entrepreneurial spirit, I think, a little bit, to be successful. You got to be willing to say, okay, well, how do I attract new clients? How do I keep the clients I have? How do I provide value to my clients versus, you know, the other person down the street who, you know, could provide similar service, maybe at a more competitive, maybe at a more expensive rate, you know, but how do you become valuable to your clients? And so that's entrepreneurial thought or entrepreneurial spirit, I think, is helpful. And then I think, you know, I think you have to, I like working with people who are collegial, who, you know, are about getting, when I'm doing a transaction, about getting a transaction completed, you know, finding ways to make the transaction happen instead of finding roadblocks to throw up to keep it from happening.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think those are the things that I enjoy working with people who do those things. You know, and I was once told that, you know, if it was easy, they wouldn't need us. Right. You know, and so I think that's just a reminder too, that, you know, there are going to be days that it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be easy. But then there are days that you help a project get across the finish line. And one of the reasons I like what I do is because generally there's something very tangible from my work. You know, somebody buys a piece of property or somebody gets to build a new project and I get to drive by and see it. I get to go to the ribbon cutting or the, you know, groundbreaking. And that's very rewarding for me because it's a very tangible result.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, no, I get that. That makes a lot of sense. Did you get that same feeling when you were involved with politics too, or is that something in the future?
Yeah, I did actually. I get a lot of that from politics that I, you know, was involved in. And part of the reason, so I, you know, took a vacancy at office and ran for a full term of my own. And one of the reasons that I chose not to stand for, you know, re-election was because I felt like I had kind of achieved everything I wanted to achieve in that office. And I think, you know, it's a small office in that, you know, had a very limited scope of responsibilities, but I just couldn't imagine myself just doing it, continuing to do it, just to do it. And I think that, you know, my view of some politicians is that's the rut they get in, is they don't know what else to do. So they'll, you know, continue doing the job they've held for however long. And I think that's just the wrong reason to continue to be in those roles. You know, you should have a goal of what you want to do and how you want to achieve it. And when that's done, then, you know, maybe it's time for the next person to have their opportunity. I don't know if I'll ever be involved as a candidate again, but happy to support people who, you know, whose vision I agree with. And, you know, I'd probably be more involved in local, you know, politics now because it affects my work more. You know, the development environment for a community is important to the work that I do. Mm. And so I get more involved in those kind of situations and frankly, on both sides of the aisle, you know, because I don't think in local government, the national level politics or political identifier are nearly as important,
yeah,
as they are, you know, the higher up you go in towards state and elect in federal office.
Got it. I understand that. Yeah. What is sort of the trend in you live in Indianapolis? What's it like there these days? I mean, how are things sort of evolving there?
As far as the development work,
No, I'm just curious, just the city. I don't know much about Indianapolis. I mean,
yeah. So Indianapolis, you know, it's got its own little weird government in that, you know, we have a city, consolidated city county government. So you have, you know, one mayor, but then you have other little pockets of strange, you know, political layering. I live in what's called an excluded city. So I live inside Marion County. Technically, I live in Indianapolis, but I have a separate mayor and separate city council. So I actually vote for, I'm very represented. I vote for two mayors and five city councilors I get to vote for. So Indianapolis is that. And then you have the donut counties, which are the more suburban counties. And they are, most of them are very fast growing. So the fastest growing counties in the state are those suburban counties. Probably many of them started as white flight kind of communities, but you know, now are becoming significantly more diverse, and you know, are the fast growing. So you have the Northside County, which is a very fast growing county. That's where, you know, your IKEA goes. That's where your Topgolf goes. That's where, you know, kind of all the national or regional, you know, big draws come there.
Yeah.
And then the south side has some of that as well. And then you have the west side of town that has the airport, and then which has kind of all the development that goes around the airport. There's a big FedEx facility there. And then on the east side of town, you know, is becoming a pretty significant logistics hub, and south side as well. So we have a large number of Amazon, Walmart, you know, there was a big Carvana distribution facility. So there's a lot of those, you know, very, very heavy logistics focused development occurring.
Amazon, is it a big hub there for Amazon? I would imagine.
It is. Yeah. There's on the south side of town, there's millions and millions of square feet of Amazon distribution facility. And then the northwest side of town, there's a big Amazon facility there as well.
Yeah, I would think so, because you're pretty central, right? So I would think big distribution point.
Yeah, I don't know what the statistic was, but there was a statistic at some point that, you know, 70%, 75% of the country's population was within a, you know, a 12-hour drive. So you have a pretty big, you know, opportunity to be the central, truly the crossroads, call ourselves the crossroads of America, and truly are in many ways.
Yeah. No, I would think so. Like, that's why Chicago, Illinois, right? Those areas are big distribution points, manufacturing centers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I mean, do you get involved with that kind of work in your practice?
A little bit of the distribution, you know, the warehousing, flex space. You know, so a handful of those types of projects over the years. Worked on a pretty large, like, industrial business park kind of campus in one of the northern suburbs a handful of years ago. That has continued to, you know, grow. And looking at a second phase of that. And so a lot of the stuff, very interestingly, is, you know, very driven by local government. So they're out, you know, pursuing, you know, those opportunities. And when, so that's, it's a little different, sometimes a little different driver of that economic development. Instead of, you know, private development looking for the spot, sometimes it's the county government, you know, or city government actively marketing and attracting it. So sometimes happens a little differently. That's not a historic base of our firm for that type of work. And a lot of times those are, you know, national REITs or those types of things that are doing that work. So they'll go with some of our bigger, more national firms that are located in our market.
Yeah. Are you the beneficiary of some of the infrastructure bill that got passed?
Some of it has been, and I can tell you that our interstates certainly are the beneficiaries of them for sure. But that's more obviously more public work, and that's not something we generally get involved in.
Okay, yeah. I mean, well, Buttigieg is from state of Indiana, right?
Yeah, he's from South Bend. Yes, I've known him for a very long time. So.
Oh, you have? Okay, interesting. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would imagine it's probably less about, I mean, the Midwest is probably, they're probably in better shape than these coastal cities that have horrible infrastructure.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting. As I mentioned, I live in an excluded city. And so we have been working through sharing of some sanitary sewer and sanitary sewer upgrades, that have to go through a couple layers of government to get completed. Indianapolis has been doing a sanitary sewer upgrade because we had combined sewers for a number of years. And so that's been a huge, but that's been in the works for 10 years or so. So it's been something that's certainly part of the public world around here for a while. And I think some of that's been benefited from the infrastructure bill, accelerated some projects probably.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how that gets rolled out. I mean, I know there's a big lag between when those things pass and when you actually start seeing the dollars flow, right?
Yeah, there is, a lot of local governments have utilized them for, for some upgrades and facilities. They've used it for one-time bonuses for employees. So it's been interesting to see how some of that ARP money has come in and flowed out. But there is a lot of stuff that has, been infrastructure improvement, and then has, the state is working on some economic development, utilizing some of that infrastructure and ARP money, kind of as the state's contribution to projects. So it's an interesting to see how they can make sure that money doesn't go back to Washington, D.C., because I think that's the main goal of all of them is to keep it here and not let it go back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Huh. Interesting, yeah. What was I going to say to you? I'm just curious. I don't know much about that part of the world. I don't know. You see all the growth in the Sun Belt and, people leaving California for other states, et cetera. I was just curious about, sort of the expected growth of what's happening in that part of the world.
Yeah, I think, obviously we don't have mountains or oceans. So you got to have something else to attract people. And generally, I think the approach of the last several governors has been to, decrease the cost of doing business in the state. And so how do you limit regulations? How do you have a friendly tax environment? And that's led to some clear wins. There's a Governor Daniels who was before Governor Pence had now Vice President Pence, former Vice President Pence, attracted a pretty big Honda facility. So you had that.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so that was a big, but I think a big part of that was the regulatory and cost environment. And so I think that's something they've worked on. The logistics work, logistics, obviously you're well suited for that. But that's been a big growth industry in this area of the world. And so I think those are the things that have been attractive, the ways that tried to be attractive. And then you do have a decent amount of tech here as well. Salesforce has a large presence in Indianapolis. So that's it's the second largest facility behind San Francisco.
I didn't know that. No kidding.
Yeah. So they were that was through an acquisition. So Exact Target was the predecessor and was acquired by Salesforce.
Okay.
So that's why the Exact Target was a local locally grown company. So yeah, they have a name on the tallest building in town is the Salesforce Tower. So so you have a little bit of that as well. And then you have the unique things. You have the racing industry that the IndyCar racing that has a pretty big presence. That's all pretty high tech stuff too, as you think about it. And then Indiana has always been a manufacturing state. So you have a lot of still vestiges of manufacturing around, and some of that's become high-tech manufacturing. Some of it is, how do we redevelop those former manufacturing facilities? And then Eli Lilly has a big presence here. So you have a lot of the, not a lot, you have a number of Fortune 100 companies that are, Hillrom has a big presence in Indiana as well. So you have some of those larger industries as well.
Good stuff. Yeah. Interesting. It's a big country.
It is.
Depending on where you're positioned, geographically, it sort of influences the kind of industry you have around this. So yeah, I get that. That's interesting. Good deal. So just to round it off here, what do you want to leave with the audience about your firm? If you want to sum things up and the best way to connect.
Yeah. So first, I want to thank you for the outreach and the opportunity to be part of your podcast. And sure, it's like you built something pretty cool and a little niche, but very cool and obviously enjoyable for folks like myself. I enjoy the practice of law. I enjoy the opportunity to meet new clients and gain new clients. One of my partner's jokes always is the best clients are the ones you already got, because but never full up on that. We certainly are a firm that prides ourselves on doing good work at a pretty reasonable rate and pretty affordable, but provide good service at the same time. And my favorite thing is to have new to our market, so folks who are new to Indianapolis, and make the help them kind of acclimate and work their way through through our system. I've been very fortunate to have a number of those kind of clients that are new to the market, and it's a very fun experience for me to go bring something new to somebody's community that nobody else has. And there's lots of community pride when the first whatever shows up in their community. And so those are great clients, great opportunities, and maybe an opportunity through your listeners that exists. So our website is Clark Quinn Law, CLARKQUINNLAW.com. Can be reached through that. And then we're a little old fashioned. We still have a receptionist who still answers the phone when you call.
Nice.
I work from home, have the opportunity to work from home a couple days a week, but I'm always connected and always available and happy to meet new folks and work on new opportunities should they arise in central Indiana or Kentucky as well.
Excellent. Good deal. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
For everybody, again, just to round it off here, Russell Brown from Clark Quinn, and this is sponsored by Emotion Track, which is a legal tech platform that helps litigators prepare for mediation and trials with our Insights platform. And you got your dog there. Nice.
Yeah, she occasionally wants to be part of the Zoom conversation.
Ah, good looking dog. Let's let everybody see what you got there.
Now she's camera shy, so she's a year old Bernedoodle.
Beautiful.
So she's my work from home companion.
Oh, excellent. Good. I got one too, but not in my office at the moment, but you gotta have a dog by your side. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right, good. Thanks a lot, Russell.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You bet.